Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Today is Wednesday, October 11th, 2017. Commentary is the 72-year-old monthly of political analysis, intellectual probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. Join us at commentarymagazine.com. We give you a few free reads, then ask you to subscribe. It's $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription that gets you our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. We are closing our November issue this week, including a large symposium called Taking President Trump Seriously, a sequel to our last year package, Taking Candidate Trump Seriously, that will examine in a series of areas from trade to Asia to infrastructure to healthcare to relations with Israel and some other subjects, how the policies of the Trump administration are being implemented, as well as some other remarkable pieces. So this would be a good time to get full and complete access, because we'll be putting up the issue early next week. With me, as always, our senior editor, Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hey, John.
And associate editor, Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So, guys, former Weinstein Company chieftain Harvey Weinstein has taken himself off to Europe for sex rehab. We don't know where, and we wonder, I think right now some of us are wondering whether he's gone to a country with no formal extradition treaty with the United States, since among the revelations since last week's bombshell New York Times piece revealing the degree of his sexual predation, among the revelations since is Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker saying that at least there were at least two women who claim to have been raped, or at least to have had forcible sexual encounters with Weinstein that would constitute criminal sexual assault in any understanding of the term. Now, most of the cases that we read about, the statute of limitations has likely passed, but one doesn't know what is
going to... In New York State, there is no statute on rape.
Thank you very much. Okay, so there you go. And some of these cases weren't in New York, though. I mean, there was... I think there's some... One of them was in Hollywood. One of them was somewhere abroad. But in any case, I think, you know... he's clearly in legal jeopardy, as well as having been fired from his company. His company will be renamed. And as a producer rather than a creative person, I think it's fair to say that his career is more than over. Because a writer can write. A director, if he can sort of somehow get access to a camera, can direct. A producer exists to empower writers and directors to do this and to raise money for them to do it, and no rational human being is going to give Harvey Weinstein a penny after any of this, because of course anything happens and anyone who was in business with him will be potentially complicit in whatever, you know, evil action he might take. So his career is almost certainly at an end, but that is not the all of it, because the series of revelations that have come out do rise to the level of criminality, and if he particularly has done anything over the last 2 years, you know, either here or in Los Angeles, you know, I imagine it's going to come out. And
well, it's not all hearsay anymore. There was an audio that dropped yesterday that somebody surreptitiously recorded, which is...
No, the NYPD recorded.
The NYPD recorded. It was monstrous, and it included Harvey Weinstein admitting that he had touched a woman's breast. And she said, "You touched my breast." And he said, "Yeah, well, I'm used to that. I do that sort of thing." So whatever, it's essentially a confession.
He's used to his own behavior.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing that's going on, because then there's this whole question about whether or not the Manhattan District Attorney's Office mishandled this tape. Its people claim that the NYPD's effort to, you know, put a wire on this woman so she would get information against him was incompetently done from a legal perspective, so that they did not get Weinstein acknowledging criminal intent, which is the level of intent required for him to be convicted of sexual assault. So that's that was their brushback. Their brushback was the NYPD tried to drop a dirty dime on them by saying that it was their fault that they hadn't prosecuted him, and they said that the NYPD had done this wrong because they hadn't consulted with the Manhattan District Attorney's office, and which could have given them the proper guidance to since this young Italian model actress was wired to get Weinstein to talk, that they did not brief her with the right question to get the right answer.
I just have to say, on the point of his career being over, I'm sure it is over, but my cynicism tells me that at some much later date, some old Hollywood pal or pals of his, whoever they are, some director, some producer, some will try for a public rehabilitation campaign for him. I don't think it'll work, but I think we're going to see something like that.
Okay, way down the road. So I assume your model here is Roman Polanski, right? So Roman Polanski, who was arrested by the Los Angeles Police Department for having sex with a 13-year-old girl. She said it was forcible. The law does not see any form of consent in a 40-year-old man having sex with a 13-year-old girl. That is rape by any definition. And supposedly he had structured a plea deal. The judge then rejected the plea deal. He said the judge had no right to reject the plea deal, which is preposterous because this is how America works. The judge does not work for the district attorney that negotiates the plea deal. And then he fled the country and has been living abroad since. And then, of course, he worked steadily in that time. And then in 2002, not only made a movie called The Pianist about the Warsaw Ghetto, that for which he won the Best Director Oscar in absentia. And not only did he win it in absentia, but he was delivered of a standing ovation
by the
audience.
And had been talked about in glowing terms by people in the industry for years.
However, Polanski is a different story because, A, he is, of course, he was a hidden child. He wasn't really a Holocaust survivor, but he was a Jew who lived through the horror of the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia, you know, during his childhood. And of course he lived through the terrible slaughter of his wife Sharon Tate by the Manson family in 1969. So there are in his case, at least spiritually, some form of existential extenuating circumstances, arguably.
Well,
but there are none in Weinstein's case.
I have one more example that, by the way, I don't think have brought up in conversations about Weinstein much. I'm only thinking about it now, really. Mel Gibson, a lesser monster, but a monster nonetheless, misogynist, anti-Semite.
Here's the difference.
Paranoid, whatever else.
Caught on tape. Abusing his wife.
There's been multiple incidents. Yeah. And welcomed back with open arms by enough people. And by the way, also shamefully by a lot of people on the right who like whatever brand of his conservative religious politics are.
Okay, but
here's
again,
the difference now between Roman Polanski, Mel Gibson, and Mr. Weinstein. Hollywood is now engaged in this circular congratulatory effort for their own courage, standing up to somebody who they were silent about for 30 years. They can't simply go back on that. This has to be something now that's a crusade for themselves to pat themselves on the back and say how courageous we were. In order to go back on that, they would have to say, you know, well, maybe we weren't all that courageous to begin with. So they're more likely to make a movie about their own courage in confronting Mr. Weinstein than they are to allow him to return to his particular vocation.
I agree with this, but I also getting back to, but dealing with the Mel Gibson point. This again, the extenuating circumstance of Mel Gibson is that he's an extraordinarily talented guy.
Yeah,
and Harvey Weinstein is a thug who raised money and cut a lot of movies down that directors didn't like the way he handled them. So Mel Gibson is a monster and a talented guy. It is a fascinating thing that part of his rehabilitation will come in the next couple of months in the sequel to the Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg movie, Daddy's Home, in which he plays a grandfather You know, and there he is. People said they would never work with him again. He was through after, you know, he was caught on tape screaming about Jews, and then this horrible tape of him talking to his now ex-wife and all of that. But, you know, again, like, he is somebody who you cast in a movie and you are taking a risk that if you cast him, there are a whole bunch of people who won't go to the movie because they are repelled by him. Similarly, talent in this world does suffer from scandals often. Like, Russell Crowe's career never, who Russell Crowe arguably was the best actor of his generation. All that had to happen to Russell Crowe, who was known to have been a difficult person and somebody that was hard to work with and stuff, was that he threw a phone at a guy in the lobby of the Mercer Hotel in New York in 2005 while he was promoting the movie Cinderella Man, which had a, which was one of the best movies he made and one of the best movies of the decade. And that was kind of the end. His career blew up after that. It wasn't even a big thing. It was just a sort of, again, kind of an abuse of power, a powerful person abusing a less powerful person.
There's also a dynamic there that you're identifying, whereas talent is far more expendable than somebody like Weinstein, who is the keys to the kingdom. He's the rainmaker. And rainmakers are a lot less expendable than an actor.
I'm not sure that's right, because... Okay, so this gets into complicated, you know, aesthetic choices or something. So one of the reasons that Weinstein was in this unique position was that as a producer, he was uncommonly interested in making quality films at a time when Hollywood had gone, you know, was going increasingly populist. So he was an art house. But he started out by successfully releasing movies like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and very sort of hot, controversial fare like The Thief, The Cook, His Wife, and Her Lover, and other things, and then sort of made his mark that way. And then when he moved into the more mainstream filmmaking, he made movies like Shakespeare in Love, which won an Oscar and was, you know, incredibly literate and sophisticated. And so the idea was sort of like the Frank Perdue commercial of old. He was a tough man who made a tender chicken. Like, he was a jerk and a monster and awful, but he loved, he cared, and he was so interested in movies and had. Now, I think actually, when you know about, when you hear about him, if you know people who've worked with him, if you go through all this, that what he saw was a market failure or a market opportunity, which is that quadrant, the quality quadrant, was being abandoned by Hollywood, and that he could kind of cheaply zoom in as the independent movie craze had gone on and as a lot of people were starting to get funding for independent films from new sources of revenue and you didn't have to go through a studio to get money to make a movie, that the high end was open for exploitation because Hollywood didn't want it anymore. And so he could move into the high end and follow. This had happened in the 50s and 60s. There was a producer named Joey Levine who both made schlock garbage or imported schlock garbage like Hercules starring Kirk from Italy and Hercules movies and Fellini and Godard and sort of like the great, you know, European movies of the 1960s, which he also produced and released on the grounds that there was a market failure, that there was a market for art house movies and he was going to see it. And even though he was a colossal vulgarian in the manner of Weinstein, that he could move in on it. So if you look at Weinstein's career and the psychopathy that he demonstrated throughout it, you can say that he cared, he was passionate, blah, blah, blah. Or you could say that, you know, the whole purpose of his career was to be in a position where he could get women into his hotel room and ask them for massages and masturbate in front of them. And that he figured out very intelligently a modality to do this in which he would also be protected from the consequences of his actions by people who wanted to make better movies than they were being offered by Hollywood studios. Abe's nodding at me, but he's not saying anything.
Well, you
can't nod on a podcast, Abe.
Well, then I can. I'll just say.
This is like Edgar Bergen being a ventriloquist on the radio. Like Harry is a ventriloquist on the radio.
Because Abe doesn't have anything to say about this. It's obvious.
I approve of what John said. I agree. You know, the stellar analysis.
It's not just the studio system. It wasn't just Miramax. It wasn't just the Weinstein Company. It was apparently a variety of other institutions, including news and television media, including the sponsorships, the corporations that benefit from these sort of things. It was the entirety of the entertainment system, and that's why people are saying now that this one guy is indicative of a much, much deeper, broader problem with male sexual predators in industries that protect them, not in news, in television, in media, in film, in politics, in advertising, in just corporate life. It's everywhere, and we're just simply acknowledging some of its existence now and digging deeper into it to perhaps divine and uncover a much broader problem in society.
Well, I guess that's the question, really, right?
Right, but I don't. But there aren't many Harvey Weinsteins. I mean,
that's the big question.
This is where Abe's right. Like, and I think, I mean, the big question is not whether there are many Harvey Weinsteins in a continuum that are like a sleaze bag to somebody who's raping actresses in a hotel room. Like, if that's the continuum, you could have a lot of people on the sleazebag side that don't reach the summit of the raping a girl in a hotel room side.
Well, the thing is that the problem for people who want to make that point is that we no longer know. We just don't know.
Okay.
And for people who are committed to the idea that that is a problem, almost with a religious conviction,
right,
that it is unfalsifiable, this is absolutely supportive evidence.
So the industries that you mention have a lot in common, right? So the entertainment industry as an industry is a somewhat structurally unconventional industry that helps predation. That is to say, there's a lot of work goes on in unconventional places. People aren't like working together in an office in which, as we were saying before, it's sort of like an office is like the eyes on the street that Jane Jacobs refers to in her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, society's norms are kept in, are reinforced by the fact literally that there are people watching other people informally, not like the Stasi or, you know, a block committee in Cuba, but that, you know, people aren't going to, you know, mug you or rape you on a street in which there are 20 people sitting on a stoop looking around.
Who know everybody who comes around.
Right. They know who's a stranger and they know something's uncomfortable. Okay. So offices function that way. Like, it's not that easy to, you know, work your will in that way. The entertainment industry is a lot of productions go on. They travel to a remote location, they live in a motel together, or it is common to go to the Cannes Film Festival. And when you're at the Cannes Film Festival, you don't have an office space. So people come to your hotel room for meetings or something like that. Now, ordinarily, people, most industries won't say, come to my hotel room for a meeting at 11 o'clock at night, but it makes a certain degree of sense in show business. And similarly with news media or entertainment media, you know, people are off-site, they're wandering around.
Or as you brought up before, campaigns, political campaigns.
Right, well, that's the big, so we all know this about politicians are sleazes, right? So the latest is this guy Murphy who resigned from the Congress for being a pro-lifer who then, you know, said his girlfriend should get an abortion, right? Apparently ran an evil, horrible office for decades or 15 years. But it isn't to say that it is an open secret, as people said about Harvey Weinstein, that political campaigns involve sleazy middle-aged men who are sleeping with teenage interns whom they then help get jobs and who in whom there is a kind of explicit, almost explicit promise of mentorship that is, this is beyond question, you know. These are hothouse atmospheres. Now, it may be consensual or non-consensual. Maybe they want to do it or they don't want to do it. But one of the reasons that people get addicted to working on political campaigns, particularly men, is that they are sexual playgrounds, and they have been for decades, centuries maybe.
So it seems like you have an early indicator, a leading indicator of somebody who's going to engage in this kind of behavior is that they're just a jerk. That they're rude to people, they're scummy, they don't care about your personal space. So you can kind of see that coming. Now, do these industries with loose morals attract scummy people, or do these industries with loose morals create scummy people?
That's an, I mean, as with all such things, that is a very profound question, and it's not answerable as a, you know, I mean.
No, I want you to answer this right definitively and but authoritatively right
Abe,
now.
What do you?
I think there are scummy people in all industries. Yes, but so if there are probably more of them drawn to entertainment because of the sort of emotionally ambiguous undertaking of it all, because you're dealing in sort of abstract ideas and representations of human relationships and emotions and beauty also, by the way. Let's not forget, you know, entertainment is driven, especially if you're an actor or an actress, in part by the desire to be worshipped as an object of beauty. And that creates all sorts of problems in and of itself.
I would add to your point, which is all 100% valuable, that because I grew up in the theater audience, I was a performing artist for much of my childhood. I got a performing arts scholarship to go to college. Those boundaries do not exist in the theater. You are in the same dressing room with men and women. You're naked together. You are touching each other all the time. You are very physical with each other. They're just, the boundaries simply don't exist.
Right. Well, and by the way, that has always been true of show business. Like, I'm talking about for centuries. You know, one of the jokes is that traveling people in show business were respectable people wouldn't have them in their boarding houses because their morals were loose. I'm saying that if you are a brilliant predator, and obviously Harvey Weinstein was a brilliant predator because he did it for 30 years and only got caught when he was 64 years old, like caught in the way that nailed him, you know, and has brought him down, that he understood that, yes, it's about the predation. It's not about making Gangs of New York. It's not about producing Shakespeare in Love. It was about the predation, and that there was something unique about his choice of going into show. First, he started as a concert promoter. Then he went, which, of course, is another field in which there is very weird stuff going on around concerts and groupies and all of that. Goes into the movies because if you are the sort of person who wants to find young women to dominate, whom you can get to, you know, you can work your will on, how better to do it than to say, I'm going to get you into a movie or come into my hotel room, and then you just do it. And they are looking for, and it's a horrible business. It's really hard to get it. It's really hard to get a good part. It's really hard to get ahead. And you create this ambiguous situation in which they are put. When Harvey Weinstein said, as he said to one of these people, look, if you won't get naked in front of me, how are you going to be comfortable getting naked for this picture, which requires nudity? Well, I mean, there's a diabolic logic to that. He's like, no, just do it. It'll help you get comfortable. You can be comfortable if you do it with me. Then when you'd have to do it on a set, it's going to be just so much easier.
But see, doesn't this speak to
But you can see how it would kind of, like, if you're a naive 19-year-old, it makes a certain degree of sense, right?
But doesn't this speak to a psychological point that the all-consuming desire for fame is a deeply unhealthy thing, and that, you know, this sort of, you know, you can't, if you don't, well, I can't say that.
Well, it's a double-edged sword.
Yes, I mean,
in a lot of ways, there's no achievement, cultural or creative or aesthetic achievement, without the desire for fame as a spur, right? Fame is the spur, as John Dryden said. You need it. You need the hunger for recognition and celebrity is one of the things that makes it possible to achieve. However, it's a horribly distorting thing, and it's really dangerous. It's spiritually dangerous. It's personally dangerous. It's,
and when the opportunity is dangled before you, you will sort of, you know, let a whole lot slide, you know,
right.
You know, including your dignity. Now, the part that gets me a little crazy is if we are supposing that this is a sort of industry-wide, multi-industry-wide plague of actual dangerous, violent, transgressive, predatory behavior. Why do we spend so much time focusing on things like mansplaining?
Right. In other words, that the minor annoyances of being alive and the habits of people habits of people that are viewed as deeply offensive aren't really
oppressive and offensive.
Right, it belittles, or maybe it distracts people from the, you know, from the real problem.
Right, that's a crying wolf issue too.
It would suggest that this is not a systemic problem. That this is not something that most women encounter in their lives, because they're so attuned to minor offenses that we elevate to these levels of great
now,
and cosmic offenses.
Right. Well, this is where
when the real thing happens, you get a sense of perspective, and all of a sudden we haven't talked about anything like those minor microaggression annoyances in quite some time.
Right.
Now, the other thing to be said is that as we are three men sitting here, you know, we cannot speak to the experience that women have being put in uncomfortable situations. But the idea that this is specific to women, that men where they work are not also placed in uncomfortable situations by their bosses that may not be sexual in nature, though they can be, I suppose, but are just generally the problems of living in a world in which there is a power imbalance, in which you have less power than the person that you work for, and the person that you work for. This happens with, that's what I'm saying, like a lot of, when you hear about this right now, you seem to think that these things only happen to women and that men somehow function in a kind of club in which they're incredibly nice and supportive and wonderful to each other, and then they just abuse women. Well, I mean, everybody is put in the position of being, say, you know, can you help me out, you know, help me, you know, I don't know, falsify my expense report, or help me do this cover for me with my wife, you know, while I sleep with my girlfriend, whatever, you know, like men can go pick up their boss's dry cleaning and stuff like that. I mean, if you read James Miller's History of the Agency CAA, you know, every one of these young men working in the agency was abused by a boss. It was like a rite of passage, you know, so I mean, abused, not sexually abused, but like in a way that many people would say, I cannot possibly allow myself to be, you know, treated in this fashion. But they see an object at the end of the goal and at the end of the road, and they do what they have to do to get there. And then they become that guy and they abuse the next person and the cycle goes on again. So this is also part of what it means to be alive. However, and this is where I think we want to get into a larger sociological case, not about how industry, this all needs to stop, but the degree to which, and Ross Douthat had said this a little bit, but the degree to which the end of all expectations of personal moral conduct as a central guidepost, that you are expected to behave like a proper moral person at work, just as you are, you know, in life, and that if you don't, you are dismissible, you are shameable, you are humiliatable, and that, you know, we live now in a world in which all these codes have fallen to pieces, and in the end result, one of the things that happens is that people like Harvey Weinstein can work their will without them. Okay, guys, let's talk a little bit about Casper mattresses. I'm not allowed to say it's my favorite of our advertisers because I love all of our advertisers equally, but I have a special feeling for Casper mattresses because my three children each sleep on a Casper mattress, and I can say of a certainty, maybe this is correlation, not causation, but the institution of Casper mattresses, introduction into our household, made two pretty bad sleepers after it. The two pretty bad sleepers got to be two pretty good sleepers. So I am very fond of Casper mattresses, the sleep brand that created an outrageously comfortable mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house as a sleek design and is delivered in a small how-did-they-do-that-size box, which really is an amazing thing. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft breathable sheets. The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. It combines supportive memory foam for a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Free delivery, free returns, 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Because Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to be spending a third of your life on it. So, obsessively engineered mattress, shockingly fair price, marriage between foam layers for ideal firmness, right sink, right bounce, affordable price because it sells direct to consumers, free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada, 100-night trial with over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars. It's quickly become the internet's favorite mattress based on Casper, Amazon, and Google reviews. Designed, developed, and assembled in the USA. And special offer for our listeners, get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/commentary and using commentary as your promo code. That's casper.com/commentary and use commentary at checkout for $50 off. Terms and conditions apply. So let's move on to today's really bizarre news, wildly, I wouldn't say misreported, but taken wildly out of context, that President Trump announced to a shocked defense security team that he wanted 10 times the number of nukes as that we currently have. And the entire world went crazy with this report from NBC News. And at second or even first glance to some people and second glance to others, with cooler heads, I think we realize that something else was going on here. There are two different things going on, one policy and the other process. So Noah, as our resident nuclear warhead fan.
That's about it. Not okay. Expert.
Okay. Just so kind of fan. So lay out the story for us.
Go All on. Right. So Donald Trump was apparently, according to this story, getting briefed on force posture in places like Afghanistan, and it wasn't a very productive conversation. So the brass wanted to take it to the Pentagon, where they have a very secure small room called the tank. There they would have a couple of principals who would be going over this stuff, and you'd have ostensibly a much more focused president. There he was shown a slide where it demonstrated the extent to which America's nuclear arsenal has grown and expanded and shifted over the course of the years. And he saw that in 1967, the United States had some 32,000 warheads. And today we have about 7,000, 3,000 of which are fieldable. And the president apparently said, well, why the heck don't we have 32,000 warheads? Give me 32,000 warheads, among many other things. He wanted bigger military posture, more deployments, et cetera, so forth. Bigger, better, superlative, superlative, superlative. So now the headline of this story is Donald Trump wants 10 times as many nuclear warheads, and you know, Donald Trump plus nuclear weapons equals media freakout.
Right.
And that is what we've seen. Very little analysis has been involved here. And as the morning has progressed, people have sort of taken a deep breath, I think, and begun to see that this wasn't really the story that it was, and also that there's a much bigger story here.
Let's deal with why the story is not what it was. So, Trump, a person, as we know, not exactly conversant with the details of policy, nonetheless chosen by the American people to be their president, goes to have a meeting with the military brass and says, why don't we have 32,000 warheads the way that we used to? In an extremely secure meeting. And the answer is, well, Mr. President, we don't need 32,000 warheads anymore. And then it is explained why that
So here's the thing with nuclear weapons. Let's go back to Barack Obama. Barack Obama entered office with this fantastical notion of nuclear zero. He gave speeches about how the world needs to come together to eliminate nuclear weapons. After years and years and lots of pushing from his brass, he conceded to a beefing up, a review of nuclear posture, which included more funding and more work on life extension programs. You've got our warheads that are aging.
What is a life extension program?
So the warheads are aging. You can extend their life in facilities like Y-12 and Pantex, which are, by the way, falling apart. They're literally crumbling.
You are such a show-off.
They're literally crumbling. And so you can extend their life. I mean, some of these things were the most recent nuclear weapon that was, or nuclear warhead that was developed, was built in 1987. Most of these things are from the 60s. Right. So you can develop them, you can push them ahead, you can refurbish them and get them into the 2020s, 2030s, but eventually you got to build new warheads. And that's what Barack Obama committed to doing. And they can do some pretty fantastical things. You can penetrate bunkers, you can dial up and down the yield. Many of them are low yield, so it's tactical. Okay.
So basically what you're saying is that the rational thing to do with a gigantic nuclear, and we've gotten rid of a whole bunch of warheads, as you know, in part, partially because we went from 32,000 to 7,000, because we don't need them, because the doctrine of mutual assured destruction that required that we and the Soviet, that required that we have as close to the same number of warheads as the Soviet Union had, of course, goes away when the Soviet Union goes away. And so we are not in need of matching them warhead for warhead, or multiple warhead on sitting on top of rocket for multiple warhead sitting on top of rocket. So then the question is, what do you do? Well, so the great fantasy was you could go to nuclear zero. Well, guess what? So Iran's going to get the bomb, even though Obama pretended it wasn't. North Korea has the bomb. There's going to be a nuclear arms race elsewhere. The last thing the United States needs to do is have an aging, decrepit nuclear force or get rid of its nuclear weapons. We are the only, as we now know, with the entire policy toward North Korea on the part of liberals who loved nuclear zero when Obama was talking about it, is now we have to deter them. Well, how do we deter them except with the threat of nuclear annihilation? That is the only way that we deter them. In other words, they have one warhead, we have 3,000. We're going to aim them all at their head and kill them if they try to use it.
And also, nuclear proliferation is bad, and the umbrella keeps our allies from nuclearizing.
That's
like
right.
Japan and South Korea.
Yeah, and Saudi Arabia and other places like that. That you know, Saudi Arabia falls, and the Islamic, the Wahhabi, even more serious Wahhabis take over, and then you've got Islamic extremists with a nuclear weapon. So
it is fair to say that 7 months into this presidency, the president is only now getting curious about the extent to which America's nuclear posture is what it is and where it should be. That's a fair criticism. He didn't even know what the triad was in the campaign.
Right.
So
well, that's
think
what I'm saying. He doesn't know nothing, and we know he doesn't know nothing. So now this is where we get into the secondary thing. If he can't go to the Pentagon as a person with limited knowledge of this stuff in an incredibly secure location, told about what is going on with the American nuclear posture, and say, why don't we have 32,000 warheads when we had them before, without it leaking and without him becoming a figure of sport and the idea is that he's a crazy person, when it's a perfectly rational question for somebody who hasn't read a lot about this to ask, what does this tell us about what's going on within the Trump administration?
But by the way, it tells us that there's great distrust and animosity and no respect for his understanding and leadership and infighting and every other unstable, dangerous thing. But I just want to say that this is the second round of this, actually, because remember a story leaked during the interregnum about Trump saying, why can't we just use nukes?
Use nukes, yes.
Three times in a one-hour
briefing. Yeah.
That's right.
But that was a little different, because this occurred in the tank. If the president can't be confident that a conversation that occurs in a very secure location in the Pentagon won't be compromised, I don't understand how the left doesn't see that as a national security threat.
And, in fact, some leftists... I was particularly struck by Jeffrey Lewis, who is an arms control expert at the in Monterey, California, who goes by the name of rabid Trump hater and very left wing, and goes by the name of Arms Control Wonk on Twitter. Did a tweet storm in which he said the president of the United States needs to feel free to speak in a secure setting about what is going on with our nuclear posture without fear that, that what he says is going to be reported. This is the most dangerous subject, particularly for anybody who is serious about North Korea policy. At the very least, you have to let the president have his head and having, even if you think that what he needs to be told is that his own predilections are wrong or dangerous, that has to be something that happens in a safe space.
So I've seen two reactions to this from Democrats. The first, which I think is very dishonest, is that this is a noble enterprise. This is virtuous and a level of defiance.
To leak against him, you mean.
Because this man is dangerous. He is crazy. He is unfit to be commander-in-chief. And anybody who behaves in this fashion is acting as a patriot and a rational supporter of American security. And I think that's 100% dishonest. They don't like Trump and they like to see him humiliated. Second, the idea that leaks occur like this on the regular and that it happened to George W. Bush and Barack Obama is also patently false. And I've seen demonstrations to support that point saying, you know, well, there was this leak about how Barack Obama was defiantly ignoring the recommendations of his generals to insert more troops into Afghanistan, as though that's not something the president would want out for the benefit of his own political position. There really is no precedent here. This kind of stuff is unprecedented because it is such an obvious risk to national security.
The only thing I'll disagree with you on, though, is the idea that Democrats are being dishonest when they say that they think this was a righteous action and it saved us from, you know, could potentially save us from a madman with nukes. I mean, I think they do believe that.
I don't think that they don't believe that. I just don't think that they really honestly believe that it is virtuous behavior to compromise the president.
All efforts to compromise the Trump presidency are considered virtuous by those who think that it should
not exist.
But however, the problem with that is that is self-defeatingly crazy, because if you put him in a position of being entirely isolated without the capacity to have serious conversations with people on serious matters, then it's all going to come out of his head. It's all going to be just him and, you know, and his three, you know, friends, whoever he rants to at that day. And that's all that he's going to be left with. If he feels like there is literally no place he can go where he doesn't have enemies inside his own tent, that will drive him crazy. That's not that, you know, that. And if you're worried that he may be crazy, maybe you should be doing the opposite of trying to drive him crazier.
I agree with all this. But I have to say, what if there's something in him that makes it almost impossible to keep his confidence? Leaks were supposed to have stopped or died down with Steve Bannon having gone. What if Trump acts in such a way that he inspires such a level of chaos at the smallest central level that radiates out from that is a situation where you cannot keep secrets, where you cannot treat national security policy in quite the same way that you had been doing so.
Well, I mean, except that this appears to be a leak out of the Pentagon, not out of the White House, right?
But that's even more to the point. So it wasn't. So
we don't know.
So
it might be the White House.
But if the leaks weren't just a matter of sort of White House turf wars, what if there's just sort of too much insanity to rein it all in?
I don't know. I mean, if you're Chelsea Manning, you know, you can go rogue. Just because you're in the military doesn't mean you're 100% immune to being, you know, radicalized and, you know, to fall in with some ideological imperative. I mean, but I'm more inclined to think that this comes from somewhere political than the Pentagon.
I guess, but even he doesn't act in a way that inspires confidence and secrecy. And
I think that's perfectly fair, but I will say that, you know, we also don't know what we don't know. That's always the problem in these circumstances. Like, you don't know what the president is or isn't being told, at what level, at what degree of specificity and all of that. What we know is that he's not that interested in it, because what he's interested in is picking a fight with the NFL and then a fight with NBC. You know, as he today says, he wants NBC's license pulled. NBC doesn't have a license. I mean, it's owned and operated stations in, you know, seven markets or whatever it is have licenses. But in fact, NBC is a national network and doesn't have a license, but he is attempting once again to create a sort of, that's what interests him, are these, you know, cultural fights and the policy that we have about nuclear weapons or how it works or what its purpose are is of very little interest to him.
Which is great, by the way. That's fine.
Because entropy, right, because that's the point about this is to the extent that he is less interested.
We should not let the president be interested in nuclear weapons.
Well, that's a horrible thing, right, that we should say that. But, you know, in fact, if you think that the president is ill-prepared and wrong, then what you want to do is encourage entropy. That is to say, you want the policies that are in place, even bad ones from the Obama administration. I mean, this is part of the reason that some friends of ours who opposed the Iran deal now don't want the Iran deal to stick around on the grounds that they don't know what's going to happen if it goes away. So at least entropically, the policy remains the same. That's safer than changing it. But if you have that view, which I don't, but if you have that view, then the last thing you want to do is encourage the president to say, yeah, I want 32,000, you better build those. That's what we're going to do. Who are you? I'm the president. I got 63 million votes. You got none.
And it's also, it's not like, and this isn't the other part of this freak out that was unnecessary. You can't do that. Exactly. Congress has to appropriate that kind of money. So it's not like that can just happen. This whole thing was like a manufactured freak out over something that, and the focus of the report should have been, where the heck did this freaking report come from? Not the substanceless nature
of
it.
Well, believe me, there are people within the Trump administration who want to only to know where it came from. And if there were that few people in the tank and they're all in the military except him, they can be polygraphed, by the way. So, you know, they're in active military duty. They can be polygraphed under U.S. law. So who the hell knows where this goes? And with that moment of not exactly crushing morosity, but some version of sadness, we conclude this week's commentary podcast efforts for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald. I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.